This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. When you want the best, you have to act fast, especially when hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people before the competition scoops them up. And the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds top talent fast. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Spotify. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. It's time for the September 2021 episode. I'm news editor Ezzy Pearson, and I'm joined on the podcast today by staff writer Ian
Todd. Hello.
Coming up later, we'll be telling you how to observe the lunar X and V on the moon. But for now, we're going to be taking a look at what we learnt whilst putting together the September 2021 issue of the magazine. Now, when it comes to astronomy, there's really one instrument that defines the entire discipline, and that's the telescope. There are, of course, other ways of observing the night sky with your naked eyes and with binoculars, but certainly when it comes to the world of doing professional space science, it's telescopes that really do the lion's share of the work. And over the years, there have definitely been a couple of telescopes that have really made their impact in the field of astronomy and revolutionized how we look at the night sky.
Yes, exactly. And sort of, I suppose, if you are thinking about the telescopes that have changed astronomy, you would go all the way back to the first telescope, wouldn't you? which is generally considered to be Galileo's refractor. I mean, I was thinking about this, and you know, usually when something that's a really sort of ubiquitous invention that's everywhere, I think, you know, it's quite difficult to sort of actually pinpoint what the first incarnation of that was, you know, because who can say who was the first person to sort of, you know, create the optics that would magnify light? But generally speaking, when we're talking about sort of European astronomy and the telescope as we know it in terms of a celestial observing instrument, people go back to the Netherlands in 1608 with the spectacle makers Hans Lippershey and Zacharias Janssen and Jacob Matthias. Hopefully I pronounced those names right. So they are sort of considered to be the first people who created the concept of a telescope. But as far as I understand it, those were mostly used for earthly matters, for observing things on Earth and, you know, for military purposes and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the story goes that it was Galileo who was the first to create his own refracting telescope in 1609 and use it for the purposes of observing, bodies of the solar system, for observing the stars.
Refracting telescope is referring to ones that uses its lenses as opposed to any other kinds of things, just in case anybody listening at home wasn't
cool. Sure. Yeah. Cheers, Ez. Supposedly, Galileo's first telescope could magnify objects by about 3 times, but he kept working on the instrument, and it got up to like 8 times magnification, eventually 30 times. And the really interesting thing about when you consider Galileo's telescope and its effect on astronomy is it's not just that he created the capability of observing distant objects like the moon and the planets. It's also that it's sort of almost single-handedly changed the way humanity considered itself within the context of the universe.
Mm.
So the first objects Galileo sort of observed were like the moon. So he observed the moon, and he created sketches of the moon, and he found it had mountains and craters and all these features. And then I suppose most famously he observed Jupiter and 4 of its moons, its largest moons, which now, of course, we know as the Galilean moons, which are Europa, Callisto, Ganymede, and Io. And those, I mean, you know, astronomically speaking, it's fantastic, of course, getting a closer look at these bodies, but it's also sort of noticing, first of all, that the moon is sort of imperfect, and it's not this perfect sphere, this sort of almost like godly, otherworldly, you know, perfect sphere. It does have sort of imperfections. That was a term Galileo used to describe it when he was...
Well, whatever the word for wibbly is in Italian.
You're right, Ez. And also, of course, this idea that, you know, Earth is at the center of the solar system, or Earth is at the center of the universe, which, you know, a lot of sort of work on the heliocentric model had been done by Copernicus. You know, the idea that the sun is actually at the center of the solar system and everything revolves around the sun, mm-hmm. orbits the sun. And observing Jupiter and its moons, you know, Jupiter's a planet, Jupiter has moons. So maybe Earth is also dragging the moon across the solar system. Maybe the moon's going around Earth and Earth is going around the sun, and the sun's actually at the center of the solar system. As you said, it sort of helped us understand maybe perhaps our own sort of insignificance, but also it made those celestial objects a bit more ordinary, which I think in a way makes them a bit more extraordinary, because you sort of think, well, they're not sort of these like perfect spheres. There are imperfections, and those imperfections are there to be studied and understood, and there must be other imperfections throughout the solar system and throughout the cosmos that are just waiting to be discovered and understood.
The way that the telescope was described in the early patents and people talking about it was an instrument to make things that are far away look as if they are close up. And that really kind of hit for me, because it suddenly made me realize it is, you know, we take for granted the fact that, you know, everything's got a zoom lens and you can look at stuff that's far away. But this was just like even the concept of being able to do that was completely new to these people. So it must have been quite a big shift at the time.
Yeah, indeed. It always, thinking about that sort of thing, it always brings me back to the late Patrick Moore's house, because he called his house Farthings, which is like a play on words, mm-hmm. far things. And when you think about that, like this, it's sort of like a humorous pun, but there's also something quite philosophical about that, and something it really gets to the heart of what astronomy is, isn't it? You're just basically trying to see far things in better clarity, aren't you?
And it's just as the telescopes get bigger, things get further away. That's all that happens.
There's a few other sort of Galileo's observations that are worth sort of touching on. He did observe Saturn's rings, but he didn't realize that there were rings. He thought they were like perhaps moons, or I think he called them arms. He wasn't sure what they were. And it wasn't until Christian Huygens used even better telescopes about 50 years later that he was the first to sort of say that they were rings, which is obviously why where the Cassini-Huygens name got its mission got its name from. You know, the Huygens lander that landed on Titan, named after Huygens, who'd discovered Saturn's rings. And he was also Galileo was also one of the first Western astronomers. There was like a group of European astronomers who sort of independently of one another were observing sunspots at the time, which are these sort of dark spots that are cooler spots on the surface of the sun. So they appear darker than their surroundings. And they were some of the first Western astronomers to observe them. But apparently we now know that Chinese astronomers were observing sunspots as long ago as like 165 BC. And we've got records of that. But as I say, that was one of Galileo's big observations as well. But I think ultimately, you know, as we've said already, sort of getting beyond the actual practicalities of Galileo's telescope and what it enabled him to see, I think its biggest achievement was just almost sort of kick-starting the field of astronomy, and also this idea that the human race isn't at the center of the universe and the Earth isn't at the center of the universe, and there are mysteries yet to be solved and everything can't be sort of explained away by perfect circles and perfect sort of symmetry. But it brings us nicely onto our next telescope, because I suppose Galileo's observations of moons and orbits was one of the sort of concepts and theories that was later developed by Isaac Newton, and who sort of, many would say, improved upon Galileo's telescope design, would you say?
Well, he came up with a different design. Whether or not it was better, I think, depends on who you talk to. What he designed was the reflecting telescope. So this was a telescope that used mirrors to focus the light instead of lenses. So exactly the same principle of using magnifying and focusing light to make the image bigger. And he wasn't the first person to try to do this. Lots of other astronomers had been trying, such as Niccolo Zucchi and James Gregory. Were two of the people who'd also tried, but Newton was the first person to be successful. And this was in the mid-17th century, so only about 50 or 60 years after Galileo had made it hit the first telescope. And the reason why people were trying to find another way of making telescopes was because Galileo's kind of telescope was affected by something called chromatic aberration. And what this meant was that the light sort of on the edges of various objects picked up these kind of like blue and orange fringes. And nobody was quite sure what they were. Newton worked out that what was happening was that light wasn't a single color. It was made up of lots of colors, and the lenses were actually splitting apart that light and creating this chromatic aberration. So he decided the best way to get around this was to just get rid of the lenses entirely and use mirrors. The problem was that they needed to use a very specific shape of mirror called a parabolic mirror. And these were very hard to produce. It was a very specific shape. Because bear in mind, at this time, everybody was trying to produce their mirrors by hand. You know, they were grinding them by hand, and they didn't have, you know, all of the fancy instruments we have today to make sure that it was exactly the right plane, exactly the right shape. What Newton did, compared to the other people who'd been trying at the time, was make a spherical mirror, which is a lot more of a kind of smooth shape. It's a lot easier to grind. It's a lot easier to sort of make sure you've got it correct. This did introduce a new type of problem. It got rid of that chromatic fringing aberration and introduced spherical aberration, where different bits of the light hitting different places on the mirror don't quite focus in the same place, and it blurs out your image slightly. But a lot of people thought that that problem was better than having these weird coloured fringes on the sides of your telescope. He first showed his telescope off to the Royal Society in 1671, where it was an absolute hit. Everybody loved it. He ended up demonstrating it to King Charles II. And it's become, you know, the basis of pretty much every mirror-based reflecting telescope since, has been Newton's, based on Newton's design. Another 50 years after he made it, John Hadley, another astronomer, came along and worked out how to make parabolic mirrors, eliminating the spherical aberration. And then again in 1930, somebody else came along, Mr. Schmidt, and created the Schmidt corrector plate, which was, as it sounds, just a plate, glass plate that went in front of the telescope, and that adjusted all of the light slightly so that you could make a spherical mirror focus and get rid of the spherical aberration. And that made telescopes suddenly much cheaper and easier to make as well. So Newton came up with the original design, but it has been adjusted and perfected in the years since.
Yeah, and it's incredible. As you said, you know, it's, you know, Newton's design informs the reflecting telescope today, which, you know, like the Newtonian telescope, you know, being the Newtonian reflector being a perfect example. And, you know, this is the same with the refractor. You know, both models are still being used today by amateur astronomers and professional astronomers. You know, I mean, you sort of think about the reflecting telescope built in, you know, Birr Castle by Lord Rosse, you know, the Great Leviathan in Ireland, and so many other famous telescopes since then, huge observatories that have adopted that sort of reflecting telescope design. It's incredible, isn't it? You know, like you make something and it's a good design and it stays, you know, like it's sort of tweaked. It's tweaked throughout the centuries, but, you know, it's like a good design is a good design.
Yeah, they just basically got bigger. and, you know, you fix the odd problem here and the odd problem there. And now it tends to be, do you like to have the because mirrors are cheaper and easier to make than lenses. So do you want the nice, cheap mirror so you can have a good lot of area? But mirrors are a bit hard to, they take a lot of finagling to reflecting telescopes. So instead, do you go for the refracting telescopes, which you basically just plonk on a tripod and you're good to go?
And you don't need to collimate it or anything like that, yeah.
But yes, most of the professional telescopes out there in the world today are based on the reflecting, on the Newtonian design. And there's one particular one, which other people might have heard of, and that's the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah, might just have heard of that one.
Might have heard of that one.
I know, I mean, like when you think about, you know, Galileo and Newton and their telescope designs, if you could go back in time and tell them one day there's going to be a telescope that's actually going to be in space orbiting Earth, I mean, that would just absolutely blow their minds. They just wouldn't believe you. But yes, no, as you say, I mean, you know, you can't talk about telescopes that changed astronomy without talking about the Hubble Space Telescope, which, you know, launched on 24th of April 1990, launched into Earth orbit. And yeah, it's a telescope that orbits Earth. The idea goes back to the 1940s. It's sort of attributed to the US astrophysicist Lyman Spitzer Jr., who spoke about launching a telescope into space so that it could observe beyond the distorting effects of Earth's atmosphere. And then in the 1970s, you know, the US Congress approved funding for what would eventually become the Hubble Space Telescope. Hubble was named after Edwin Hubble, who was a famous US astronomer. In the 1920s, he made observations that proved the Andromeda Galaxy lay beyond our own galaxy, and therefore there are other galaxies beyond our own. And also his calculations led to evidence that the universe is expanding. So it's sort of no wonder that, you know, the Hubble Space Telescope was named after such an influential astronomer who made some of the biggest discoveries of the 20th century. And I'm also thinking, you know, when you sort of go through the list of deep sky objects that the Hubble Space Telescope has observed over the decades, loads of them are, for example, like Messier objects or like NGC objects that were, you know, maybe first discovered by, you know, astronomers like William Herschel. And again, it's that idea of going back in time and seeing, you know, William Herschel looking at a sort of distant galaxy or nebula, as he might have known it, and just imagining what he saw when he looked at a specific galaxy or deep sky object, or, you know, globular cluster or something like that, and what we've now seen with the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's just completely changed the way we look at the universe. I suppose, you know, like you can't really talk about Hubble without at least talking about the optical flaw that had to be corrected, can you? You know, I mean, that's sort of like it was a pretty big pretty big failure at the time, I think, because I think they were pretty sort of NASA was pretty sort of lampooned in the press, weren't they? You know, this massive telescope has gone up and using public funding, and now it doesn't even work.
Oh yeah, no, it got. I remember there was the film Naked Gun featured a joke. It was like a list of all of the like biggest, most expensive failures throughout history, and the Hubble Space Telescope was one of them. And that was a film done in between that era.
Oh, right.
So it was a big joke at the time.
Okay, I didn't know that. It's years since I've seen that film. I have to go back.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
But you know, the great thing about Hubble was it was designed to be serviced. So once they came up with the idea, they sent, you know, astronauts up on the space shuttle and fixed the problem. And then throughout the years, various space shuttle missions have repaired and upgraded Hubble. And you know, with new technology, as new technology has become available. And when you think of some of the most, you know, iconic images of space, They have probably come from the Hubble Space Telescope, you know. So it's had that sort of direct effect on popular culture and sort of I suppose like astronomy in space and cosmology within the mind of sort of the general public, you know, sort of non astronomers. So I thought it'd be worth just going through a list of some of the just a few of the many things that Hubble has done. It's helped astronomers determine the age of the universe. It's pretty good. It's not a bad one.
Good stuff.
It made the first confirmed detection of a supermassive black hole at the center of galaxy M87. You think of the Pillars of Creation image in the Eagle Nebula, these cosmic clouds, and you can see sort of newborn stars shining. The Hubble Ultra Deep Field in 2004 revealed over 10,000 galaxies, some nearly as old as the universe. It's been used to explore gravitational lensing, which is a phenomenon initially predicted by Einstein, where the light from distant galaxies is magnified by the mass of closer galaxy clusters. So it's sort of like a cosmic magnifying glass, using the mass of galaxies as a sort of a magnifying glass, which is pretty cool. Closer to home, it's observed, iconic features such as like Jupiter's Great Red Spot. It spotted fragments of Comet Shoemaker-Levy crashing into the planet. It's produced the first ever images of Saturn's moon Titan, and it's discovered moons around Pluto, rings around Uranus. It's made measurements of exoplanets, you know, planets orbiting stars beyond our solar system. I mean, you know, you could do a podcast on just the Hubble Space Telescope alone, which I think we did do quite recently during one of its anniversaries.
Yeah, you could write that people have written books and all kinds of things. There's 15,000 scientific papers, at least, have come. That's the last number I have. Numbers probably gone up by now. Have come out of data taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, and that's just going to go up and up.
Exactly. And you know, even after Hubble retires, when it eventually does, you know, that data will be used by generation after generation of, you know, PhD students writing their papers and, you know, planetary scientists and cosmologists and astronomers. Speaking of its retirement, there were sort of fears relatively recently, weren't there, in the past few months that Hubble was in a bit of trouble, but it seems to have pulled through, doesn't it?
Yes. So Hubble is, at this point, it's well over 30 years old. It's beginning to show signs of its age. So back in July, back in June, there was a computer fault, basically, that put it into safe mode. And the team behind Hubble ended up taking a month to get it back online. Hubble had problems previously with various things going off online. You know, stuff happens. But most of the time, NASA could get it back online almost instantly, like, and just be down for a couple of days. But this time it was down for an entire month, which had a lot of people worried. And it's, you know, it's basically, Hubble has lots of backups on it. Every space mission does. But now the backups are beginning to, they're relying on a lot of the backups, and the backups are beginning to fail as well. So there is concerns that the days of Hubble might be coming to an end. We don't know when, and they are going to, I'm sure that NASA is going to run Hubble until it dies. it's just way too useful not to. So we will have to wait and see. Hopefully it will be around for another couple of years yet. Hopefully it'll made it to its 35th anniversary in 2025.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping.
And at least
for.
We'll get another podcast out of it.
Exactly.
just before we move on from space telescopes, there is another one I wanted to talk about, which is SOHO, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which is a joint NASA and European Space Agency project, mission. Which launched in 1995. And rather than sort of looking outwards to the cosmos, it's looking inwards because it's looking at the sun. It was only supposed to operate from 1995 to 1998, but it's been so successful that its mission has been extended multiple times, which is pretty useful if you're observing the sun, because the sun goes through a period of peaks and troughs in its activity, quiet periods, and then really active periods of about 11 years. These are called solar cycles. So SOHO has lasted longer than anticipated, which means it's the data can sort of analyze these peaks and troughs, these solar cycles. And, you know, when you think about it, if you're going to launch an amazing telescope that can look at cosmic objects without the distorting effects of Earth's atmosphere, you would launch one to look at the sun, wouldn't you? You know, that the sun being the source of our life, being, you know, has sort of a constant influence on the planets and other bodies of the solar system, shapes and affects them. So understanding the sun sort of helps us understand the processes of the solar system. And it's also, you know, observing the sun is also, it's really our best chance at our best opportunity to observe a star up close, isn't it? You know, like there's a star just there that we can take a look at and analyze and work out what's going on. So SOHO has looked at solar phenomena like coronal mass ejections and prominences, all of which sort of, which do you think need to be better understood. So SOHO has really led the way in solar science. It's captured images of the sun's convection zone, which is this upper layer of its interior, and it's studied sunspots. And that's really cool, thinking back to Galileo and all those other European astronomers observing sunspots, or even going back to, you know, 165 BC when those Chinese astronomers were looking at sunspots and working out what they are. And now we've got an orbiting telescope showing us them and, you know, amazing images of them up close and examining them in different wavelengths and things like that. And it's also been measuring the solar wind, which is this stream of charged particles that emanates from the sun and generates aurora and sort of affects the bodies of the solar system. But apparently SOHO has also discovered 3,000 new comets, which I didn't know. And these new solar phenomena called coronal waves and solar tornadoes. So it's had quite a sort of lifespan so far. It's incredible. If you go to the NASA SOHO website, there's amazing images and different wavelengths of the sun, and you can see all these glorious videos and animations and things. It's fantastic. It's not really spoken about that much, but
It's the sun doesn't get the credit.
Definitely.
In astronomy. And it's like, you can go on the SOHO website and, you know, look at daily updates and see what's going on with the sun right now. And there have, since SOHO, there's been a couple of more solar probes that have gone out, particularly the Solar Orbiter and the Parker solar probes. But those are ones that are going to be getting right in close to the sun, whereas SOHO's kind of set back quite a lot. It's near, closer to Earth orbit, so it's looking with a very big telescope from a distance, but that gives us a great view, and hopefully helps us predict whether a solar storm is on the way, whether we're likely to have aurora tonight. All of these kinds of things come from SOHO.
Yeah, fantastic object.
So those are some of the big telescopes from the past, but obviously people are constantly building new ones, and there's quite a few that are on the way, which, whilst they haven't changed the way we look at astronomy yet, they're probably going to in the future. On Earth, there's been a big boom lately in building what's called extremely large telescopes, because astronomers like to name things very simply sometimes. And this is the sort of collective name for any telescope that has a mirror over 30 meters. And the reason why we haven't built any mirrors this big before is because, mainly, for a long time, there wasn't any point. One of the big advantages with Hubble is that it's above the Earth's atmosphere, which means it's not affected by something called seeing. That's where the Earth's atmosphere wavers as it's different heat, as it's moving around. And that causes the light passing through it to waver as well. And it blurs the image. So if you've got a mirror that's over a couple of meters wide, there's no point in getting any bit, because usually with a telescope, the bigger the mirror is, the finer resolution you can get. But over a few meters, the resolution is so fine that it's just blurred out at that point by this effect of seeing. That changed in 1990 with the invention of something called adaptive optics. And this is where, underneath the mirror, you have a bunch of little arms, little fingers, that basically just poke at the mirror and deform it slightly. These are, of course, robotic fingers controlled by a computer, not like lots of people standing there poking it. As funny an image as that is, I just had in my brain. But what that does is it deforms the mirror slightly, and using various things like using a guide star to lock onto and some fancy computer work, the telescope can actually correct out this blurring effect from the motion of the atmosphere. And that suddenly meant that you could build telescopes that are, you know, 20, 30 meters across, and you'd get the benefit from them. Unfortunately, you then have to work out how to build a mirror that is 30 meters across. That is incredibly difficult. Like, for one thing, just the logistics of building something that big. Like, how do you grind a telescope that big? How do you transport it? And also there's a much bigger problem, which is glass is heavy. Yeah. Metal is heavy. And in fact, it gets so heavy that if you were to build a telescope that big, it would deform under its own weight. So instead, what they do with these big telescopes is they cut them up. And if you look at the sort of designs for these telescopes, they are made up of dozens and dozens, sometimes hundreds, of hexagonal mirror segments that slot together. And that's how you come up with these absolutely huge, or we will in the future come up with these absolutely huge mirrors. There are currently two over 30 meter telescopes being built. I should add that these are over 30 meter visible light telescopes. We've been building absolutely huge radio telescopes for years. You know, there's one that's half a kilometer across in China. But when it comes to visible light, they tend to be much smaller. So there's two over 30 that are being built. There is the 30 meter telescope. Again, very on the money name there, being built on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, and that's due to be finished by 2027. And then there is the European ELT, European Extremely Large Telescope, that'll be built in Chile, and that's going to be ready in 2025. And both of those are currently under construction, so hopefully we'll be seeing those soon. And who knows, there might even be more along the way.
Yeah, I mean, That really hammers home what you were saying about moving a mirror of that size, because they have to be in places like, you know, the Atacama Desert in Chile, where, you know, like you could, like just...
But you can't put it on the back of a truck. Because it's not even like it's 30 meters long. It's also 30 meters wide. Like, no. Yeah, so you have to cut it up and put it in.
Yeah, or putting it in Mauna Kea or something like that. It's absolutely incredible, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But because I suppose, you know, even harder would be launching that into space. So the adaptive optics enables you to build these huge telescopes and not have to worry about launching them into space, because you can correct for the distorting effects of Earth's atmosphere through AI, essentially?
Yes, exactly. You can. Having said that, they are launching one into space. it's just that this one is going to be a little bit more modest. It's going to be 6.5 meters across, but again, with this kind of segmented mirror. And that is the long-awaited James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST. And this is, it's been billed as the kind of successor to Hubble, in that it's going to be the next big space telescope. But it's actually very different. It doesn't look at visible light. It looks at infrared light. And that's really useful because infrared light can get can go through things like dust, which obscures most of what Hubble looks at. And also it's given off by things that are too cold to give off visible light will still give off infrared light. So that lets you look for things like planets and stuff. But what's really cool about JWST is it's been made up of a whole bunch of 18, in fact, hexagons that are gold plated. It looks very shiny, very bling, if you ever look up the pictures of it.
It's so cool, isn't it?
It is. And these are all honeycombed together. Unfortunately, a 6.5 meter mirror is still too big to go on a rocket. Most rockets are only about 3 meters across. That's why Hubble's mirror is only about 2.5 meters. So what they've had to do is they've had to put these 18 sections together and then fold up the mirror so that it'll fit in a rocket.
That's amazing.
Which it's just, the idea of folding up a mirror amuses me quite a lot. And then when it gets into space, it will unfold. But it was supposed to launch many, many years ago, but it has been beset by a lot of delays. The biggest one is to do with its sun shield. So the JWST is looking at infrared light. That means you want your telescope to be very cold. If you don't have a cold telescope when you're looking at infrared, you might as well have built a regular it's like building a regular telescope out of light tubes. You know, all you're going to see is the telescope, not what it's looking at. So they have to keep it very cold. And they do that through this thing called a sun shield, which is a tennis court-sized umbrella, basically, which shields the entire telescope from the sun. And again, this needs to be folded up so that it can fit into the rocket to take it into space. But it's made of this incredibly delicate foil, Kapton foil, which is the same thing that they put on. Like, if you ever see a picture of a satellite and it's covered in some kind of like shiny silver or gold foil, it's that. And it's incredibly delicate, incredibly difficult to work with. And back in 2018, it tore whilst they were trying to put it together. And they've had lots of problems with trying to get it completely so that it won't, you know, so that they can guarantee that this incredibly expensive mission has ended up costing $10 million approximately, doesn't get into space. And then, you know, this thing they've spent ages on just tears the second they try to open it up.
Because unlike Hubble, it can't be serviced, can it? Because it's not in Earth orbit. It's far, far farther away, isn't it?
It's at something called the second Lagrangian point, which is 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. As opposed to Hubble, which is 500 kilometers away from Earth.
Yeah, so you got to get it right.
You got to get it right. Also, there's no space shuttle anymore to go out there and look at it.
And then, you know, obviously, they had lots of problems in 2020 with sort of COVID and restrictions. I remember at the time, about this time last year, talking to a JWST scientist, and it was that's basically what they were saying, was, you know, a lot of their problems this year have just been really just, well, in 2020 have been COVID related.
I know that there's a lot of, because the JWST, because it's just going to the second Lagrangian point, it doesn't matter too much when it launches. There are some times when it's better than others. But if you've got something like the Mars rovers, like Perseverance back in February last year, that has to go in February or it won't get there. Like, So it did mean that the JWST was sometimes a bit pushed back in terms of priorities. But that said, the launch window has only slipped by about a month from when they were hoping. So it's only a couple of months. And it is aiming, hopefully, they hope will launch in November this year. So in a couple of months, we could be finally seeing our first images from the JWST. Which it's kind of like a weird one for me, because pretty much throughout my entire career in astronomy, which has been going on for almost 15 years now, people have been talking about the JWST. It's one of those ones that has been being built and worked on and developed, and everybody's saying it's like, oh, and well, when we get the JWST, we'll be able to look at this thing or be able to do that thing. And so the fact that it is finally about to go up is quite strange to me.
Yeah, definitely. I think that will definitely warrant a podcast special before the end of the year, won't it?
Absolutely. Hopefully you'll be saying it's all brilliant and wonderful and working well. but that is certainly, it looks like it is set to be the next big telescope that's really going to change how we look at the universe around us. Its goal is to investigate the early universe, to look at things like the formation of galaxies and stars and planetary systems. These things which tend to be surrounded and shrouded in this thick layer of dust that other telescopes can't see through. Looking at possibly even the origins of life and how that came to be throughout the solar, throughout the universe.
Okay.
And the infrared is one of the most effective tools to do this with.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah, it's really exciting thinking about what potentially lies ahead. I mean, the other big project that I've been thinking about recently is the Square Kilometer Array, which you were saying, you know, we've been building radio telescopes much, much bigger. And the Square Kilometer Array, you know, we could do an entire podcast on that. It's going to eventually connect radio telescopes around the world to have, cover an area of a square kilometer of, you know, viewing capability.
We've been talking about how like telescopes have been getting bigger, but it's with sort of using arrays and things talking to each other. The other one that I think of is the Event Horizon Telescope, which was telescopes literally all over the world, from, you know, one on the South Pole, to look at black holes. And it's really exciting. Another field which has been really advancing, of course, is not even looking at light. It's not looking at electromagnetic radiation, whether that's radio or visible light. And that's gravitational waves. You know, in the last decade, we've had these various gravitational wave observatories coming online and making their first detection of this thing that was predicted, you know, 100 years ago back by Einstein. And that's opening like an entire new avenue of astronomy. And there's another new one of those observatory coming up called the Einstein Telescope, which we have a feature on in the September issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. So if you want to read about that or any of the other telescopes that we've talked about here, we have features on them in the September 2021 issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine.
For this month's stargazing tip, we're going to be taking a closer look at our celestial neighbour, the Moon, and in particular, two examples of a type of feature known as a Clair Obscur effect. Clair Obscur effects on the Moon are tricks of light and shadow, where sunlight and shade produce familiar shapes on the lunar surface. And because the phases of the Moon are cyclical and repetitive, over the years, some clair obscur effects have become popular targets for lunar observers. Now, this month, see if you can spot the Lunar X and the Lunar V. These are an X-shaped and a V-shaped formation that appear along the line dividing the lit and unlit portions of the Moon as seen from Earth, which is known as the Terminator. Both letters are visible for just a few hours, and you should be able to see both the X and the V at 9:30 p.m. BST on the 13th of September. Use a pair of binoculars or a small telescope and see if you can spot them. The Lunar X can be found about one quarter of the way up the Terminator from the Moon's southern edge, and the Lunar V can be found slightly north of the halfway point. A full guide on how to see these two effects can be found by visiting skynightmagazine.com and searching for Lunar X in the search bar at the top of the page.
that's it from us this month. You can find out more about the telescopes that change astronomy in the September issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also take a tour through variable stars that will be visible in the late summer night sky, tell you what you need to study if you want to prepare for a career in space science, and we'll be previewing the upcoming Einstein Telescope Gravitational Wave Observatory. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. So from all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.